Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 6th. This is episode 9. I'm Matt Weaver, and I am again here with, as always, Scott Nelson.
Where else would I be?
Exactly.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Scott. So, thank you for bringing me coffee.
You're welcome. My coffee is empty.
This is what happens when you drink it all before we start.
I know. I need to conserve better. No, next week I'll just bring 2 cups for me.
Is that a large?
It was a large.
Yeah. They need a Scott-sized grande.
I guess.
Yeah. So, well, let's start. So there's been this, the New York Times has had this fairly interesting web article about music out there for a while now. And let's talk about it. At the very least, let's skim over it so that we can get the link into the show notes, because it's like 25 songs that tell us where music is going, as decided by whoever the heck wrote this article at the New York Times. So I don't know that it really tells us where music is going, but there are a couple of things in it that I found interesting.
I guess, I mean, it's definitely informed suggestions, right? Someone has done research, someone who is paying attention to the music scene wrote this, so.
Yes. I have found in my old age now that I kind of stumble across music. I don't actively seek it out anymore. I don't know what this says about how old I am. I still like the music, but I spend no mental ergs seeking it out. Sometimes I'll stumble across it and then be interested, but I don't know. People change, I guess. So anyway, let's start. The one that made me laugh is Lionel Richie. Right? There's a mention of Lionel Richie and the song Hello, which I'm old enough, I remember when this song was new in the 1980s, right? This was part of you know, a period of time where Lionel Richie was big, right? And now it's apparently been discovered again by the next generation. And so it kind of floored me. Like, I don't know. It's not a great song. It has kind of a funny video, because the person in the video is blind, I believe. The woman in the video is blind. But I don't know, do you remember this song?
I know the song. No, I don't. I think he was on The Tonight Show doing a sketch with it. Have you seen that?
Uh-uh. Maybe it'd be worth seeking out.
Probably. That's interesting. What was the justification for?
It was basically
this
saying
old song being new again.
You know, it's a piece of pop music that seems to have transcended its time and place, right? That's basically was their argument. So I don't know. That's cool.
Okay. Yeah, it was. I saw this. And when you Google it, the title of the article is Jimmy Fallon sings Hello with Lionel Richie's head. So there's your teaser. You must seek it out and watch it because it's hilarious.
Yeah. Who's the guy that drives around and sings with people in the car? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
He's on later, right?
Yeah. James, like, Corden.
James Corden.
Is that it?
Yeah.
He's really funny.
Yeah. We'll know if Lionel Richie hits mainstream if makes it.
He gets in the car.
In the car with James Corden.
I wonder, maybe it's just because Adele came out with a song called Hello, and so people started Googling Hello. And
stumbled across this? Yeah. Maybe.
I mean, that's a legit thing that happens.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, with song titles, they never do that, like, put the date in the title kind of thing. You know, like movies. Movie names that get recycled, you go to IMDb and it's like, it would be like, Hello 2016.
Yes.
You know, but songs, like, you can recycle song names, right? And nobody...
That's right.
Huh. So Lionel Richie, anything else on the 25...
Yeah,
songs
so
tell us.
There was, I'm not normally a country person, but there was a country artist named Margot Price who caught my eye. I've since listened to some of her stuff on iTunes. She's interesting because she is not the, supposedly not the same sort of like manufactured country star that is common in the industry today. The article spends a lot of time talking about her hard past and getting up on stage and singing, and, you know, all the old timers saying, "Oh yeah, that's real country music." As by way of trying to convince you of her authenticity. Either way, I have liked what I heard of her music. So Margot Price was good. And then there's a third person called Matt Chamberlain, who's a drummer. And I believe he actually has a CD, but the write-up about him was fascinating because he is a session drummer, but he is probably one of the best drummers out there. And as more and more music gets made on the computers, right, the room for session musicians has shrunk because I just don't need somebody who can play the drums in an average way to be on my CD, because I can do it, you know, in the computer on a drum machine and it's good enough. But this guy works a lot, and he's apparently on speed dial for a lot of big name people. When they want effectively a human's touch and the creativity that comes with it, the article talked about a lot of times, you know, people call him and say, "Man, I'm really stuck on this song. Can you come and, you know, spend a couple days with me and help me figure it out?" And he does, and it really helps. You know, he really works in service of other artists, helping get their creative juices flowing. I don't know. I thought the article was fascinating about how the is a larger context of our society about how just being merely average at something isn't nearly as valuable as being truly outstanding at something, right? So anyway, Matt Chamberlain.
Cool. I see there is a track from Hamilton on here.
Yes.
Which is interesting. I do think it's a pioneering...
We've talked about your fascination with that play, right?
Yeah.
You really like it. I haven't listened to the music. I haven't seen the play. You could suggest I've been living under a rock.
Yes. But it is really something new and original as far as like a Broadway musical goes.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand why it would make a list of the new direction music is going in. Definitely.
Well, you'd almost not be taken seriously if you didn't mention it. If you had a, you know,
right. If we're looking at where country is going, where drumming is going, where pop is going, I mean, this is where,
yeah, and rap music and all kinds of other things in there, yeah, too, right? Speaking of music, did you see the new Apple commercial with Taylor Swift, or Taylor Swift commercial for Apple? Did you see this?
No.
It's advertising playlists on Apple Music, right? So Taylor Swift, like, you know, is on a treadmill and she's commenting about how much she hates doing cardio, and she picks, you know, some Apple Music, you know, workout flow playlist or something like that, right? And it starts playing some Drake song, I think, and she's, you know, running on the treadmill and singing the song, and then gets totally distracted and face plants. And that's the commercial.
Well, now I gotta see it.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
No, I hadn't even heard of it.
Yeah,
I guess you have to watch TV to see commercials.
I don't watch TV. It came across some website I pay attention to.
Interesting. Okay. I'll have to check it out. So what's the deal with Apple and Taylor Swift? Is this part of their 10-year plan that they've established of how they're going to mutually benefit each other?
I don't know. Mm. It's,
you remember that whole deal where she called him out for not paying artists? Mm-hmm. You know, it was speculated that that was some collaboration between her and Apple for her to be the voice of the musicians. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. But obviously there's some now continuing relationship between the two businesses.
Yeah, the relationship is fine. The older I get and the more aware I am of corporate America, the more I'm sure that all of that conspiracy theory stuff cannot possibly be true. Right? She had a platform. She stood up and yelled really loud. And, you know, once the sting across Apple's face subsided, they chose to engage, which was good for them. Way better than this Nest drop cam Twitter fiasco. Is good. Have you paid attention to this?
No, but before we move on to that, do you think that's a change for Apple? I mean, you know, Apple's notoriously vindictive. Like in the Steve Jobs era, when Taylor Swift calls Apple out, don't you think he would have said, you know, forget Taylor Swift, she's dead to us?
Yes, that's, Apple was vindictive because I think Steve Jobs was vindictive. Right. Right. The Greenpeace thing is a telling story, right? When Greenpeace first called out Apple on their lack of green stuff in Greenpeace's eyes. What the hell is that?
It was my phone, sorry.
when Greenpeace called out Apple that first time, Steve Jobs was apparently angry, right? Like, you know, I've got a bunch of money and I want to put the hit out on Greenpeace because these people are dumb. And it took, you know, it took Al Gore, who's on the board of Apple, to take Steve Jobs aside and say, you know, they are dumb, but there is some basic truth in what they're saying. You're going to fare better at this by understanding the truth or not of their claims and then owning the conversation and having it on your terms, which they did eventually choose to do, mm-hmm. which is why there's now the environment reports that come out with every new product. And it's why
they're on stage at the town hall meeting, right, talking about their energy efficiency.
Yep. But that was not, you know, if the stories are to be believed, that was not Steve Jobs' first reaction, right? Mm-hmm. His first reaction was vindictive. Right.
Greenpeace is dead to us.
Yeah. And it isn't that Apple wasn't doing green things. They just weren't publishing them.
Right.
Right. It is rumored that Steve Jobs used to give donations to various charities, but he would always do it anonymously. He never,
you know. Well, I mean, he was a hippie at heart, right?
Yeah.
That's my understanding of Steve Jobs, you know.
And, you know, he never wanted to seek out the fame and fortune for being charitable with his gazillion dollars, mm-hmm. that others have. And he took some criticism for that. But he didn't care because it wasn't what he was interested in talking about.
Right.
So.
Okay, tell me about Google Nest and Twitter.
So Tony Fadell and the guy who runs Dropcam, whose name I can't figure out, right? So, you know, Google ended up buying all this stuff, and Dropcam came and worked for, got like sucked into Nest, right?
Okay, so Google bought Dropcam.
Pretty sure.
After they had purchased Nest. It wasn't like Nest bought Dropcam.
I don't know.
But they were conjoined.
Yeah, Alphabet ended up owning the whole mix and merging the two groups together.
Okay, because Nest was doing some sort of home surveillance camera product.
Yes. And I guess comments had been made about, you know, we took these 100 Dropcam employees and, you know, some outside observers said a lot of those Dropcam employees left shortly thereafter. And Tony Fadell basically said, yeah, they were crappy employees anyway, right? Which then started this war of words across Twitter about, you know, whether they were good employees or bad employees and how much money Dropcam makes compared to the Nest products and, you know, so on and so forth, right? Which is,
yeah,
it's been ugly.
Well, I feel like over the last couple of years, you consistently hear tidbits of, you know, Tony Fadell being a jerk to people. Like, I feel like that's this undercurrent that he's ruthless and he tells people if they go on vacation to not bother coming back and anecdotes like that, you know, whether they're truthful or not, but.
Well, he's clearly angered somebody, right? And,
yeah.
And they're coming for him now. You know, I don't know, right? To be honest, I don't care.
You don't have any Nest products, do you, or home automation?
No. I was very intrigued by the Nest smoke alarm. But then it came out and it had some kind of notorious failures. And it just kind of turned me off to it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. At the end of the day, the home automation stuff is interesting to me from a technology perspective. I have not yet seen anything actually worth the money. I have friends with Nests. They love them. You know, I feel like once every 6 months they tell me about some update that happened to their Nest for which they had no control, which broke it. The one I just recently read about was some update a few weeks ago failed for a bunch of people and it burned out their batteries. So then people would wake up.
Their heat was off.
Their heat was off because the Nest was batteries were dead.
Right. I read about that one.
You know, so my stupid programmable thermostat on the wall for all of its, you know, early 90s tech.
Works. Always.
Yep.
Yeah.
So.
Didn't they get in a bunch of trouble this week too? I read an article about some home automation hub device that Nest had purchased and now they're shutting down.
Yeah. And I'm
talking about that's the container of hummus thing on Medium, which was such a weird analogy.
Not only are they shutting it down,
it's going to stop working.
It's literally going to stop working. So it's not like there's no more updates for it. And this thing that you spent a couple $100s on will just be frozen. It's like, we're shutting it down.
Yeah. And whatever services you're using that device to provide, you know, you're going to have to find a replacement today. So the equivalent is if they did that with the thermostat, it would be like, you need to go to Menards and buy a new thermostat or find an alternate solution. I mean, it's not quite that drastic, but it's same idea.
It's a, it's not a great way to build long-term customer loyalty. I don't know. It's, all this stuff is coming and I can imagine my life being improved by these things, but nothing on the market yet fulfills anything that's of value to me. Right. I don't know. Nest, the learning thermostat, you know, people tell me it's great. I've been programming my thermostat since forever. I don't understand people who can't. If you can't program your thermostat, then perhaps you should reconsider
being a homeowner.
Right? It's, you know, I don't need the thing to learn when I turn it up and turn it down. Right? I know that I get up at whatever time I get up.
Yeah.
And at that point, I want the house to be whatever I want it to be. I can do that. And on the rare occasions where that's not appropriate, I can just manage it manually. So,
yeah,
the Nest solves zero problems that I have. Which I get. That's me being an old guy standing out in the yard yelling at people to get off my lawn. I totally get it, right? It just, it hasn't been flawless. It seems like it's more pain than benefit.
I've heard several public figures and like people on podcasts and stuff talk about buying Nests and using them and then stopping, you know, switching back to a traditional thermostat, because it would just do crazy things and it would never do what they wanted it, what they actually wanted it to do.
Yes.
So I've never really been interested in it, even if it worked. Because like you say, that's not a problem in my life, dealing with thermostat rules.
Right.
I don't really care about my lighting or my smoke detectors. Like, the only thing I'm interested in home automation wise is probably door locks. Like, if I could open my door with my phone, I would like that. But to date, any options for that I've researched are pretty terrible.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was this one a couple years ago that was big called the Lockatron, where it was a device that you essentially put over the deadbolt. Oh, and it was like a mechanical device that was then controlled by a Wi-Fi radio to unlock the door. But it had all kinds of problems. And if like the battery died while it was unlocking it, you know, you like couldn't get it off, or I don't know, there were all these weird problems with it. And I haven't looked into it since, but I mean, that's the one homeowner type problem that I do have occasionally, is locking myself out of the house. Mm. But I have my phone on me. Gee, it would be nice if I could punch in a code, you know, or something.
And you wouldn't even need it on every door. You'd really just need
just one door,
a door that you could get in.
And I know, I mean, you can already kind of do that. Like, they have doors where you can have a punch, you know, punch code panel. Mm-hmm. People's garage doors do that and stuff. I think it would be nice to have a modern door lock mechanism. But nobody else seems to care about that. I don't know. That doesn't seem to be a big thing. People are more worried about like changing the color of their lighting.
Yeah. Well, so Slage, which makes, they've made door locks for forever, has a line of these electronic locks. That is interesting. I am interested in being able to unlock a door electronically. I just have the same pause about every Internet of Things thing, which is, you know.
Right now we're taking actual physical security and putting it in the hands of digital mechanisms.
Right.
That are hackable.
That are written by people for whom writing code is not their core competency.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's similar to the car API we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you know, Slage's core competency is building good locks.
Right.
It has nothing to do with electronics.
Yeah.
So, you know, it gives me pause, makes me be willing to wait for something else, wait for somebody else to prove them out. And all of the experience I have with commercial level electronic unlocking systems, those systems are horrible. They are truly despicable. I mean, they're giant pieces of expensive, crappy software that are barely maintained because there's no competition.
Right.
You know, Honeywell makes one of these, and there's probably two or three other vendors, and that's all there is. If you want to have you know, a RFID card reader on the wall that you swipe that then unlocks the door for you to get in, like you've seen at every business you've ever been to, right? You have to buy one of these things, and that's all there is to it. And it's just crappy software. So, eh.
I have seen, I can't remember what it's called. It's a doorbell product. Have you seen this, where it's like a video camera, and when your doorbell, when somebody rings your doorbell, it pops up on your phone, you see an image of who's there, you could speak, you know, you can speak to them. It maintains a record, so it stores, an image of who was at your door.
Yep.
You know, motion detector kind of stuff. It seems to be gaining popularity, and that it has a lot of investment. I hear it advertised on a lot of podcasts and stuff.
Yeah, because that is a handy thing. I used to work with a guy who, he worked at home, and, where his office was diametrically opposed to where the front door was. And if you're at home all day working, I mean, you know, the Girl Scouts come by and sell you Girl Scout cookies, and the FedEx guy comes by and delivers you a package, and your mail carrier comes by, and all of these, you know, things happen that caused somebody to...
The people who are bringing you a new version of the Yellow Pages every 6 months and just puts it on the pile outside your door. Right.
And so he found the disruptions kind of annoying because the doorbell would ring and you're far away, so you have to kind of immediately drop what you're doing and kind of run through the house to get to the door before they leave. And so he installed a camera just outside the house on the porch, right, so that he could see, oh, it's the FedEx guy, I can go in 10 minutes, or,
right,
you know, oh, it's the, you know, the crazy religious people that I don't want to talk to, or whatever it is, right? And you
turn can, lights off, pretend not.
That's them. Right. And so that is a, I don't really know if that's a real problem, but that's a legitimate use case, mm-hmm. I think, of having a camera out there. And I don't, you know, I'm a pretty big privacy advocate. And if I'm standing in front of somebody's house ringing the doorbell, I really don't care if they've got a camera there that says that they can see, oh, hey, yeah, it's Matt, right? Don't let him in. I mean, that's okay.
At that point, I mean, they're on your property. They're on your doorstep.
Yeah.
It seems perfectly reasonable to take their picture.
Yeah. That's okay. I don't know. For whatever reason, that doesn't cause me to put up my privacy shields the way other things do.
So I assume that's what Nest is doing with Dropcam, or that's what their product is some sort of surveillance.
I don't know. It's
you know, I have a Synology NAS, and they have a what do they call it? Like security station. They have a software product and cameras that integrate into the Synology to record your surveillance video.
Yeah.
And it's something they really push. I guess I didn't realize that was such a popular thing. Maybe it's more small businesses.
Yep.
I don't know. Like, do a lot of people have surveillance cameras at their homes? Is that a thing now?
I think it is kind of a thing now. I don't know how valuable it is at home, but it is certainly valuable in a business case. I have an uncle who is a locksmith, and so he runs a little business that does, you know, security, right, for homes and small businesses and stuff, right? And the various, you know, he's like, the cost of adding a camera to just record stuff, it isn't necessarily a deterrent, but the cost is pretty low. And then if something does happen,
you have some evidence.
There's some evidence,
hmm,
which may or may not be valuable to you. But it can at least, be more likely for you to understand. Like,
right,
he told me the story of a guy who, he had a camera recording stuff in his garage, right? Just what was coming and going. And there was somebody in a gray Dodge Ram pickup truck with some accident damage on the side, like, pulled up in front of his house, and the guy, you know, the garage door was open, and the guy, like, ran in and stole a bunch of tools and ran out and drove away, right? Because the door was open and he was in the backyard and whatever else, right? Well, the tools are gone, but now he has this evidence that he can share with the police. Well, mm-hmm, you know, here's this guy who's roughly this tall and driving this vehicle, and in a few days they found him, right? Because the vehicle just happened to be distinctive enough, right? I mean, it was a crime of opportunity,
mm-hmm,
but there was some evidence of it, and, you know, recovering the tools or whatever is probably pays for that system for the rest of the guy's life, right?
So I always think about that when I'm in my backyard working and leave my garage door open.
Yeah.
It'll occur to me, what if somebody's, like, stealing my bike out of my garage? Now I'm going to be even more paranoid.
That's right. Clearly, you need a camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm happy to add to your fears. Mission accomplished.
I guess the play for Synology then is, you know, it pushes you for another reason to have a NAS. And it's the concept being storage is so cheap and easy.
Yeah, well, Synology...
Why not just record video feed 24/7, you know?
Everything,
keep it for weeks.
Everything Synology can do to get you to fill
use storage.
If Synology is good for them, right? So that makes sense. There's a company. This software they make is called Security Spy. I think that's what it is. It's Macintosh software for using webcams or network cameras to record, like, onto the Mac, right? So you can get your old Mac, put a couple of network cameras up wherever you need to put them up, and it'll record that stuff for you. It's pretty powerful software for do-it-yourselfers, right? And it's the person who does it is in England, so it's priced in
pounds.
In pounds, but it's £30, which is not crazy money. So yeah, we'll put that link in the show notes. But it's kind of cool. I know multiple people who have used that software to great effect. All right, what else we got to talk about?
You'd put in here an update about Siri.
Oh yeah,
Apple has fixed some of Siri's problems.
Yeah, because you were suggesting that this will never happen, right?
Yeah.
And Siri has since been updated to have at least some rudimentary understanding of sexual assault queries. And Apple has partnered with the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network.
RAIN.
And now suggests, you know, you to seek help in partnership with these people. And so that is, you know, kudos to Apple for doing at least the bare minimum. But I think this is the beginning of a long slog for not just Apple, but everybody, right? If Microsoft and Google and Amazon want to also be competitive in this space, their AIs, you know, Cortana or Hey Google, what's Amazon's called? I don't remember. Anyway, they're going to have to understand how to try to help somebody who's in a crisis situation and not provide a flippant answer.
Alexa. Which is always very confusing because there's two terms. There's the Echo, which is the device, and then Alexa, which is the entity.
So did you see that Amazon released a how to make your own Alexa device out of a Raspberry Pi? They released some code.
Really?
On GitHub?
No.
Yeah.
So is there's like an Alexa API? It just does it. It sends the voice online.
I haven't looked very deeply at it.
I have a spare Raspberry Pi sitting around, nothing happening with it. So
you should build one and report back.
Huh. I'll look it up. So on this Apple thing, it is interesting. I wonder how many people were involved in deciding what precisely the language would be. Because did you read this? It's kind of interesting language in that it says, you know, if you think you have experienced sexual abuse or assault, you may want to reach out to someone at the National Sexual Assault Hotline.
Right.
Like, it's very...
My guess is...
It's a gentle suggestion.
Yeah, but my guess is RAIN already knows what the right answer is.
Yeah.
They already understand what the right language is and what it means in a legal context.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is all Apple had to do was call. And they said, yes, we'd love to help you. You know, we'll send somebody right over who will tell you everything that there is to know, right? And my guess is they would love to do it with Microsoft and Google and Amazon.
Sure.
And hopefully they will. So, yes. So that's good. Who says the media is dead? They can still make companies do things.
Yeah. So... You don't have an Amazon Echo, do you? Have you thought about getting one?
No.
I don't really see the point, but man, it is very well reviewed. And I hear people talking all the time about how amazing the Echo is and how often they use it.
My phone will do, hey Siri, I turn that off too.
Yeah.
I just don't feel the need to talk to my computer yet.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't really get it either. I mean, a lot of people like the, you can say, hey, play me this particular song, or, you know, start playing this audiobook or whatever. But it's really just like two taps on the phone to do that.
Yeah, I'm too old. I would just do it.
Yeah.
When I set timers all the time on my phone by tapping to set the
timer. It's just a swipe, tap, tap. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm just set in my ways, I guess.
Yeah, I never use Siri for that kind of stuff either. But I don't have... I'm one generation before you can do Hey Siri, so I don't have whatever that processor is that...
Right. You have to be plugged into power.
Yes.
So, I think it comes down to all of the things that Hey Siri can do are simple queries, and so they're simple enough to figure out with just a couple of taps.
Right.
I do understand a lot of people say, oh, I love to use it when I'm in the kitchen and my hands are dirty and I can't touch my phone. That I get. But I, you know, I'm not doing childcare. I'm rarely, you know, elbows deep into muck when I'm preparing food. So it just doesn't help me. I would love if it could understand deeper queries.
Right.
And then I would probably converse with it all the time, but we're not yet to the Star Trek computer. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
I have a touchscreen computer in my kitchen. It's just a PC. It's kind of a piece of garbage computer.
Yep.
And I had always been kind of anti touchscreens, you know, like I didn't really see the value. Like I don't see the value in a touchscreen laptop.
Right.
However, this device I use a lot, and it's really nice when your hands are wet or you're doing something to just tap the screen with your knuckle, you know, or a finger, and not care about getting it wet or dirty or touching a keyboard or a mouse.
Yep.
I actually do use it a lot. Hmm. Surprisingly.
Is it because it's there and you have invented use cases for it? Or is it actually solving a problem you have?
I mean, I think it's actually solving a problem of... I mean, I use it mostly for watching, like watching Netflix or watching something off my NAS while I'm cooking.
Yep.
Or eating or doing dishes. And so to not have to touch a remote or a keyboard is useful. But if I guess I could, you know, be using Cortana and say, you know, pause.
Yeah. Show me the next episode. Yeah. Of
but I, once again, I don't have a problem tapping the screen, you know, with my wet finger. Like, yeah,
you heathen.
But I have seen value. I guess that's completely unrelated. I have seen value than that. You know, and Apple's been very reluctant to deal in touch screens on computers.
I think the research suggests that a human being's ability to have high accuracy with a touch target on a vertically oriented screen, like a laptop screen or an iMac screen or something like that, isn't great. It's easier when the device is in your hand, like a right, phone like or an iPod.
Flat or angled, yeah.
So, and, you know, whenever you see somebody using their Microsoft Surface in laptop form and they reach up from the keyboard to touch the screen, it's clunky.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they like it. Yeah. Just like you like it, because yeah, there is some value in being able to touch the screen to do stuff. But it's not great.
Well, the other hang up too is if I had like a big, beautiful iMac, I wouldn't put it on my kitchen counter. Like I'm surprised when I see people with these beautiful computers in their kitchen, because I mean, this Lenovo, I mean, it's a cheapy Lenovo all-in-one I have. And when I'm beating eggs or whatever, I mean, it gets splashed on it and it gets dirty, and I wouldn't want to have my, you know, beautiful 5K iMac sitting on my kitchen counter. I don't know. So the touchscreen point is moot, right? If I'm only going to use it in an office.
Well, the counter argument to that would be, why would you not want to put the beautiful things, beautiful objects in your life in a place where you can see them and use them?
I guess, but I would feel much worse about splattering egg on an iMac.
It has a glass screen. It'll clean right up.
Yeah.
No, not your bag. All right.
What else we got?
Let's talk about Let's talk about the Zen Habits article. I don't know. Are you ever, do you ever read Zen Habits?
No, I've never even heard of this blog before.
Okay.
I'm not very Zen.
So the title of this blog post is Fear is Why We Have Too Much Stuff. And if you read the Zen Habits blog, this is a common, you know, this is right in the bailiwick of this blog, right? And the basic premise here is, you know, I'll just read a little bit of it, right? You pack too much when you travel and you have a garage full of stuff just in case you might need it. This is a fear that you might need something and not have it. It's fear of lack of safety and certainty, right? And so, you know, he's pointing all this stuff out and suggesting a way for you to overcome it. And when I read this, my thoughts immediately went to our discussion a couple of weeks ago about adventure roulette, which is, you know, show up at the airport.
Unprepared.
With an uncertain destination. Let somebody else pick it. Go there for 2 days and have a good time and come back, right? And the thing that struck me about this article on Zen Habits and this adventure roulette was they seem to be coming to the same conclusion from different ends. Like, one of the things that I think people, when they like the adventure roulette idea, is this freedom, right? You've got a bag of stuff and you're free from all other things, right? There's, you're not pulling, you know, two suitcases full of stuff with you, mm-hmm. you know, in order to go have a quote unquote good time down at Walt Disney World in Florida, you know, for 5 days, right? It's you, a bag, into some place that you don't even know, right? And so because you don't know where you're going, you can't necessarily overpack for it, right? And this is saying, you know, you're letting fear, unconscious fear, drive you to make decisions about keeping stuff, right? Stuff that's weighing you down, mm-hmm. that's making it hard for you to pick up and go, right? And so I wondered if our, you know, forthcoming experiment in Adventure Roulette is going to have any applicability to learning to have a good time, learning to travel without the fear of, am I going to have the wrong clothes with me, or am I not going to have a thing that I need, right? I don't know. There's a, they seem to be two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any of that?
I think so too. I mean, I found I'm guilty of a lot, you know, there's several bullet points here and I identify with a lot of these things. And I questioned whether or not it was fear, but, you know, I see what you're saying. A lot of it is.
Yeah.
Afraid of the unknown. Afraid of regret. That's what most of mine is. You know, in your case of the trip, I mean, it's a little less harsh. As in, like, you know, I get on this trip and I realize, oh, I wish I would have brought a sweater. Now right. I'm going to regret not having packed that. Where if I had brought the sweater and we ended up going to Key West, I, you know, would have to drag around this thing that I didn't need and never should have packed in the first place.
I think the trick is to learn to trust yourself and be resourceful. I mean, for better or worse, if you go someplace and it is very cold, like maybe we go someplace and the weather turns out to be unseasonably cold and you're not appropriately clothed. Well, you know, for probably less than $15, you can roll down to the nearest Old Navy or the nearest Walmart and end up with another layer of clothing that will keep right. you warm.
Yeah.
And that's not likely to happen. And so you know, if you don't have the extra clothes with you, then you're free from it. And most of the time that's going to be okay. And when it isn't, well, you're a smart, resourceful person. Figure it out. You know, there's no wrong answers here. But it's, you know, having the trust in yourself to figure out a good answer on the fly is not something that a lot of people have the ability to do. But a lot of people don't seem to have the ability to think very clearly for themselves, right? They can get flustered and frustrated and caught up in the emotion of a thing and not give themselves a 5-minute timeout to sit down and think about where they got to go and what they got to do. So, I don't know. I think this is a learnable, practicable skill.
I do. I think, I mean, the fear aspect of it is a little plainer when you're talking about getting rid of things. Getting rid of things that may have sentimental value.
Yep.
You know, lots of times I won't get rid of stuff because I am afraid I might need it or want it at a later date, even if that seems unlikely.
Yeah.
You know.
I've practiced getting rid of stuff, even though if you come to my house, it doesn't always look like it. But what I find is, my book collection is a great example of this. I have a big bookcase where I keep, you know, all of the books that I've read. And when I first got this bookcase, which has been some years ago now, I kept finding boxes of books and caches of books around my house. It was kind of astonishing. Like every time I'd be like, oh, this has clearly got to be the last box of books that I've got stashed somewhere. Then 6 months later, I'd find another one. It was mind blowing. But shove them all in this bookcase and eventually the bookcase fills up. It's like, well, I got to get rid of some of this stuff because I want all of my books to fit in this bookcase. And so then, you know, just start scanning the titles that are on there. And with a certain regularity, I'd pull one out and be like, why do I even have this book anymore? Right? This doesn't make any sense. And so I get a big stack of books that I literally had no attachment to whatsoever. I couldn't fathom what possessed me in an earlier point in my life to even waste the money to buy the stupid thing, right? Get the big stack of books and then go donate them to the Friends of the Library or sell them at a used bookstore or whatever, right? And any book that I pulled off the shelf and I was like, I don't think I need it, but maybe I do, I just put it back, right? And then 6 months later, I'd come and I'd do it again. And eventually, all of those books that I was like, maybe, eventually I'm like, eh, no, get rid of it, right? Like, it just required the first time to touch it and have some doubt whether to keep it. But then you put it back, and then it, like, works in the back of my unconscious mind for several months until the next time I pull it out, I'm like, bah, get rid of this stupid thing, right? And it's kind of astonishing what you do if you take some conscious effort to go through your stuff and be like, you know, this, no, this, yes, this, no, right? And I've done this in my closet, right? And eventually you understand, I really don't need 87 t-shirts, right? This one is stupid. I don't like this one. This one has...
You mean you don't have stacks of t-shirts in your closet that you know you're never going to wear again, but you just don't want to get rid of? So they're in the, like, keep indefinitely for no use stack?
Nope.
Oh, I have one of those.
No, because, you know, once or twice a year I go through and I'm like, why do I have this stupid thing? Chuck, right? And I... All of the decision-making can be wearying because making a lot of choices, right? So I just do it in short spurts, right? You'd be astonished what you can do in 15 minutes of focused decision-making. But then I kind of, you know, I set aside a bunch of stuff to get rid of. I get rid of it and I feel better. I feel lighter. I feel happier. It's an unusual thing. It's the same feeling you get when you clean up your room, right? The room is clean. Everything is up off the floor. Everything is where it is. And there's no mess. That kind of like calmness that comes from the sense of order. Same thing I get when I throw away the 10 stupid t-shirts in my closet. I know that's very new agey and crazy, yeah. But it's a real thing. No, I'm with
you. You know, that's interesting when you talk about the two-phase process, like you're planting a seed of whether or not I want this thing and then come back and reevaluate it. I think like my mindset at any given time makes a difference too. Like my level of resolve at this moment, like sometimes I'll start sorting things and like I'm being indecisive and I can't decide. And no, I mean, it's just like, I'm not in the mindset to purge right now. Mm-hmm. And other times it's like, you know, this is gone, this is gone, this is gone. So I have to choose my moments when I do sorting and purging.
Right.
When I have strong resolve.
Well, the thing that I've noticed is as I've done this, it helps me think about when I'm buying a thing. Because now when I buy a thing, I think to myself, what are you going to feel when you're getting rid of this thing, right? Is this really a thing that, you know, in 6 months you're going to be like, ah, I was stupid. Why did I buy this thing, right? And I'm not perfect at it, right? But it just that extra pause, you know, is this really something I really want? Mm-hmm. Or is this just a shiny bauble that I'm attracted to irrationally right now? It's a virtuous cycle.
Okay, now I want to go home and get rid of stuff. You know the best way to motivate yourself to get rid of stuff?
Yeah.
Watch an episode of Hoarders. Seriously. Oh, some of my best like cleaning times in my life have been after watching Hoarders. Because it like puts the fear of...
Yep. Sometimes when I'm being particularly irrational... And I don't ever actually want to do this, right? But some of my friends will tell you that every so often I feel like the clutter or the physical things in my life are weighing me down. I think to myself, what I really want to do is grab like the three or four things that are really important to me and then burn my house down. Like just simplify everything.
Scorched earth solution.
That's right. Just have nothing. Just have a smoking hole in the ground. Sell it and go live in a hotel somewhere. Like that's... Yeah. I go through these moments where I really feel like I'm being crushed under the weight of having plates and knives and a refrigerator and... a television, right? I don't know why that is, but sometimes I do.
I'm with you. You know, I've thought about moving at various points in the past, and I've always said when I move, everything must go. Like, I'll just sell everything and then start over. Because the idea of making decisions about what to keep and moving and, like, ending up in a new place with boxes and Rubbermaid tubs stacked to the ceiling that have to be unpacked and...
Yep.
Nope. Start over. Burn it down.
A friend of mine once... moved to Japan to, he lived there for a couple of years. He worked in a sake factory, learned to make sake, right? Rice wine. And, where he and his wife were going to live was a very tiny little place, right? So they'd been living in America, obviously had all the things that Americans have. And then they're going to move to this little postage stamp of a room in Nowheresville, Japan. I mean, literally it was... The place where they were was the last stop on the subway and then go a little farther, right? So it really was a rural place in Japan, if you can imagine that. And so I helped him move out of his apartment, right? He got rid of most of his stuff, saved some of the stuff, right? You know, maybe 10% of what he had. Stored that at his mom's garage, right? I moved to Japan, and he was really, in a lot of ways, kind of sad by having to do this. He's like, man, all of this time and money and effort and energy I've spent accumulating all this stuff, and we're just getting rid of it. And I said, I'm jealous of you. Mm-hmm. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, you're choosing an orderly way to jettison all of this crap and start over. That's brilliant. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to do the same thing, which is the same mindset that I have when I'm like, just burn the damn house down,
right? Exactly.
Get rid of all this stuff. Right. There's two sides to it. Right. But, certainly there is such a thing as too much stuff. So yeah. What else you got?
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing else, huh?
I went and saw Batman versus Superman, which I know you have also seen, but it would require an hour to talk about that. So we'll have to save that for another time. And I just haven't had enough coffee to get through that discussion.
I think if we're going to talk about that, we should do it at night and we should open a bottle of scotch and drink away our sorrows about how bad that movie was. God.
I don't know.
Superman is such a brilliant superhero. Why can nobody figure out how to tell a Superman story that isn't insanely dumb?
I don't know. But that's all I've seen or been up to this week.
Oh, well.
I shouldn't have got it started.
And now I'm going to be for sad next time. All day.
It's okay. We'll go out to lunch. Cheer you back up.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.